W-E-F-T, champagne. That's better. All righty. Welcome. And good morning. All right. Thank you, Stevie Wonder. You just dropped me back down to this cold, cold world. And it is cooler today. But that's okay. Right? Because we are in October. And when we're in October, well, then October X is like this. And I love it. I love it being here now and being with you. Okay. So what do I have in store for you today? Well, I always have more than I have time, and I have no idea why I think I have more time than I actually do. But there's so much to share when I'm here. Okay, first of all, my guest for the second hour will be Annette Simmons, and she is a consultant, master storyteller, and author of The Story Factor, Influence and Persuasion Through the Art of Storytelling, and the new audiobook of this volume, now in its third edition, and one of the 100 best business books of all time. And her topic is reducing the rate of incarceration in the U.S. through the art of storytelling. She says, different story, different policy regarding incarceration. Changing the story changes the national conversation. Telling a story gives the opportunity to come to the same conclusion you have without telling them what to think. The Story Factor, Influence and Persuasion Through the Art of Storytelling. So, that shall be interesting to have this conversation. I've read the book. Well, I shouldn't say I've read every page of the book, but I have read at least more than three quarters of the book. And I've also looked at other information regarding what she has on, listened to some audio of hers about storytelling. And once again, I feel storytelling is something that we all do, except we probably don't realize to what degree we are telling a story and how that story is affecting us or influencing other people as we tell a story, also as others listen to our story. And what is our story? And what does our story tell? So we're constantly telling stories, and so that's a natural thing. And so I don't want to get too caught up in the structure of what does it mean to tell a story, but here's clearly, I guess, a person who has spent a great deal of time observing and paying attention to how story is so important, why it's persuasive, how it influences, why it can influence, and also how we can frame what we are saying so that people will listen. Hopefully they will listen. Or do they listen? Oh, it's so interesting. If I start getting off into tangents about what's going on recently in the news and all of that, and the presidential election, lots of story in there. Okay, for my first hour, I've got to get into that right away. I'd like you to listen to another author and a actor, activist, and a author. Actually, it's an interview or a conversation, I would say more of a conversation, but it's facilitated by James Baldwin. And it's regarding a book that was written in 1967 by William Styron. And he won a Pulitzer Prize for it. And the name of the book is The Confessions of Nat Turner. And what was the response to that book? It was another book written by, it was called 10 Black Writers Respond, that was published in response to Styron's book about Nat Turner. And you know that movie, of course, many of you know there's a movie out currently playing at the Savoy, was at the Art Theater, about Nat Turner. It was called Birth of the Nation. And so we've got these different stories, all right? And should you see this movie based on some other conversation regarding the director and the producer, one of the producers of the movie, and also one of the lead characters who play Nat Turner, some story about that. It's not related to the movie itself. Or do you want to see this movie, which I've read in some of the commentaries, is that it's extremely, it's not extremely, but it's very, it was violence because slavery was violent. However, though, it's graphic in that sense, and it's also realistic about what slavery was about. I'm not quite sure if it's, some people say it's not historical. People who are historians say it's not historical. But I am curious, and some people say, hey, watch it, and it causes conversation. It creates an opportunity for people to converse. And so, once again, this is a really good interview that I think would be wise for us to listen to together and kind of set the stage for you to perhaps see that movie, current one, The Birth of a Nation, if that's what you want to do, or explore some of these books around the story of Nat Turner. Perhaps read this book here, but also understand that when you're an artist and when you're storytelling, you get the chance to do that. You get to tell your story as you want to tell it. And then you also get to hear people's opinions about that, the way you told your story. And also it's important that people have a response to the things that they're experiencing. So you see, there's a lot of storytelling going on, a lot of that. And we're going to have a really good discussion with Annette. Her name is Annette Simmons. Okay, that's the second hour. And so I've got to get started with that because this is at least 55 minutes long. And so that means I'm going to cut it short if I don't get it done right away. There's an expungement and record sealing summit that will take place at 8:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. October 22nd at Stone Creek Church at 2502 South Race Street in Urbana. And so we know that when you have a criminal record, it's a barrier to employment. And so that means you become either unemployed or underemployed. And the circuit clerk, Caddy Blankman, this is her first expungement and record sealing summit that will take place. And what you need to do to get in contact with her, if this is something that would be useful, because already over 400, close to 500 people are participating in perhaps getting this in this process of realizing or learning how to, or filling out the papers. That's what you'll be doing, is filling out papers properly. So they'll show you how to do this so that you can perhaps have your records expunged or sealed. And there's some other things, if you can't have your records expunged or sealed, that you will be informed about. So I want to give you that information, the number to get in contact with her. And they also need lawyers, too, who will help in this process. There's also going to be a training for lawyers who are not familiar with this process, too. So that's the 21st. So the expungement and record sealing summit is 8:30, starting 8:30 to 5 p.m. October 22nd at Stone Creek Church, 2502 South Ray Street. And then there's an expungement training for those who are lawyers to learn how to do this if they're not familiar with this on the 21st. Let me see what else. And also they will be waiving the filing fee, which is $136 also, and waive the $40 fingerprinting fee for registered participants. So that's close to $200 that you don't have to come up with. Okay, so the Circuit Clerk's office is at, number is 217-384-3725. 217-384-3725. The courthouse in Urbana. All right. Let me get that number again. 384-384-3725. All right. So I'm going to get right into this, and then I'll do a little brief interruption at 8:30 to do my underwriting announcement. So I got to do this. Okay. It's always so much. It's so nice to be here with you. And, but I really think you'll appreciate this conversation between Ossie Davis and James Baldwin, and William Styron, the author of The Confessions of Nat Turner.
I'm sitting between two friends of mine, which is an interesting position to be in. Mr. William Styron, whom I call Bill, and Mr. Ossie Davis, whom I call Ossie. And I'm committed to both of these people in many, many ways on a many, many levels. Now, Bill, he's the white cat over here. He's written a novel called The Confessions of Nat Turner, which is...
Oh, yes, I wanted to tell you, this conversation was recorded in 1968, and the book was published in 1967.
An indictment of a certain system which comes partly from the Old Testament. It's a very subtle attack on the ways, our sense of reality, and what we live by. Now, Bill Styron's Nat Turner, I'm not going to be with you very long, just bear with me a moment, is a confrontation with his history. And I'm going to say one other thing, and then I will leave it up to, I'm going to talk about Ossie, and I'll leave it up to them. I must say, you know, that I have to speak, I must say the truth, I read Bill's book not as history at all. I read it as fiction, because that's the way I read most history. And... any event in any person occurring in time is the property of any novelist. My province, for example, speaking of myself, is the province of all human life. And no one can tell a writer what he can or cannot write, especially not another writer. That's A, that's speaking about Bill Styron. Now, why this is an interesting question, and really a 20th century question, a question which has never really on this level happened in the world before, according to me, is that Ossie is also right. Ossie is talking about the film. And that means that Ossie is talking about the system which created, in the first place, the chattel, who became Nat Turner. And whereas Bill's novel is a more or less private act, and one's reaction to it is a more or less private thing, what happens with this on screen, in what we like to call America's living room, a living room populated entirely by Shirley Temples and Ronald Reagans and their really fearful offspring, is another question altogether. Ossie is saying that if one believes William's version of Nat Turner, and bear in mind, we're talking on two different levels. On the one hand, a book, and on the other hand, something at the mercy of the popular, something as dangerous as Gone with the Wind. Ossie is saying that if we make that movie according to Bill's vision of that particular insurrectionist, thousands of the black people in this country will die. So, we are confronted on the one hand with a printed page, the private conscience, and on the other hand, with a public screen, the public will. And I leave the floor open to Mr. William Styron, who wrote the book. And I will move back.
Thank you, James. Most eloquent introduction. I don't know how to go about really getting into this. I don't consider myself a public person. I consider myself a writer. And I think Jimmy Baldwin feels the same way about himself. Therefore, there's an element of extreme embarrassment in my whole presence here. I didn't want to be here, and I don't particularly want to be here now. Even more so. But I'm here, and I feel only that whatever logic dictates that I am here lies in the fact that, as Jimmy says, there, unlike most novels, this or most books, this book has done some extra, extremely extra literary things which have struck some hideous nerve ends in the public consciousness, and therefore I justify my presence here on that basis. Jimmy's also right when he says that a writer should be able to do anything he wants to if he's writing what has come to be known in the canon as fiction. Fiction is not history. History is not fiction. To be sure, logic again compels that the writer, if he is a honest man, tries to render his vision of history, if he's writing this kind of work, with as much, I would hesitate to say accuracy, because I don't think that a meticulous accuracy is all that important, but with as much truth as he is able to command. I think that, again, I hope not overly defensively, that the book I wrote is an honest book. Certainly it is not, as has been called by some people, a racist book, which I find a repellent phrase. Certainly its intention was not to grind axes, ideological or otherwise, but to portray an era of history which we are now beginning to understand to our enormous heartbreak and misery was the most crucial era that America possessed. I took as a paradigm of this era a man who actually lived, named Nat Turner, a man who to me represented what the human spirit could achieve in overcoming the most ruinous and despotic form of human bondage that men have ever imposed on other men. I conceived of him early as a hero. I consider him still a hero. Most of the readers of the book, most of the people who we call responsible critics, have felt that the heroism of the man came through. This includes, I might add, quite a few Negroes. I did it as well as I could. I did it in a way which corresponded to my own vision of what Negro slavery was. And I must say, it was with considerable astonishment that I found that after having written the book and after the book had been widely read, that I recollected Jimmy's great, one of his many great touchstones about the racial problem in America, where he said that after 300, well, that 300 years had passed during which a white man had been on the black man's back, get off my back. And I may be the only white man, I think, who has for 6 months felt that the entire Negro race was on my back. And I found it illustrative and very moving, because it has touched me deeply, because I didn't realize what kind of a hornet's nest I was going to stir up. Now, this is all I'm going to say by way of an introduction to what might develop into a closer controversy. And I would then ask Ossie Davis, that very fine representative of the arts, to speak.
The enormous presumption under which I appear tonight, one in that I dare take exception to a man in terms of a book that he has written, while recognizing as a fellow artist his absolute right to take material and treat it as he thinks best for his purposes, also as a man not easily given to acceptance of censorship in any form. I'm also presumptuous in that I have cried out aloud against a motion picture, the script of which has not yet even been written. I was aware from the very beginning of my presumption, and I took it nonetheless, and I still take it, and I do not hesitate to confess the pain and anguish that attends both the making of the choice and the execution of it. And I think we might wisely remember that the choices we make, all of us, has the choices of any consequence are those choices which draw blood. And if any of you have already a religion or a code of ethics or a morality which has answered for you for all times all questions, I envy you. I have not. I must create answers out of my own suffering, anguish, and concern. But I have the consolation that if I am mistaken, if I am overreactive, it grows out of a real concern about the problems that face not only me, but Mr. Styron and all of us in our country, particularly in the questions of race. I would like to reiterate, so that nobody here slightly entertains for the least moment, my commitment to the right of the poet, the artist, the writer, to fulfill his function as best he sees fit. My abhorrence at the idea of the interference of outside force or influence to change or to take control of an artistic work. I say that in the midst of Hollywood, where it is no longer necessary to censor a writer, it is easier to buy him. I was moved to do what I have done and what I think I will continue to do by very deep considerations. But before I get to the depth of my own concern, I'd like to ask you to remember something that happened to me and to Jimmy Baldwin about a year or so ago, which reflects on exactly the situation in which we find ourselves now. Mr. Baldwin and myself were advisors on the board of a magazine called The Liberator, which published an article that, though mild, had some of the tinges of anti-Semitism. Now, I didn't believe, nor do I believe that Jimmy believed, that the magazine or the article constituted a clear and present danger to the interest of the Jewish community, the law and order of our state. Yet, so sensitive was he and I to the possibility that a wrong tack might be taken in our collective and individual struggle, that we felt called upon to publicly take to task Dan Watts, the editor, and the magazine itself, because it was an article which could quite conceivably be interpreted as anti-Semitic. The thing that motivated me in making the statement was the fear that the effects of the article could so affect human behavior that it would become destructive. My motives in what I do now are basically the same. It is not that I attack Mr. Styron's right to create what he wants to create out of Nat Turner. It is not that I attack Mr. Jewison and Mr. Wolpe and those who are involved in the possibilities of a motion picture. What I fear is that, given the circumstances of our case, that the interest of my people and the American people at large could possibly be affected in a negative sense, and for one particular reason. My basic objection to the book, not as art, but the book as social consequence, is the author's choice of one of Mr. Nat Turner's motivations and characteristics, his love, his unrequited love for the young white maiden. And though I understand the possibility of such a circumstance and recognize that even with Nat Turner, it was not beyond the realm of possibility that he did love a white young maid, what I am disturbed about is that this is one of the areas about which I fear my country can be most immediately psychotic and destructive. I have only to think back in the last 100 years to the more than 3,500 black men lynched in the South, the rationale of such activities being that these men constituted a threat to white womanhood. I do not believe any of us here, of course, identify with what happens in the South. And I'm sure we are ready to point the finger at those people who did those dastardly deeds. Yet it was in Los Angeles itself that Petula Clark inadvertently touched the black skin of Harry Belafonte and sent a shockwave throughout the entertainment industry. Are we that clear of our horror at the thought of a black male lusting after white flesh? Are we really? Have we really passed beyond that hang-up in our consciousnesses? Have we? Had we already solved the racial problem as we face it in this country, the whole question would be academic. I would read the book, like it or dislike it, and leave it at that. But have we solved our problem? Have we made up our minds as to what we intend to do with the huge surplus population for whom our economy no longer has any place and will never have any place as long as the country exists? Those thousands in Mississippi who can't even pick the cotton anymore, what are we going to do with those people? It is because I fear that under the circumstances, some of the choices my country will make might well be racist and fascist and quite destructive, that I react, I possibly overreact to the possibility that this attitude, this act of the murder of the fair white maid by a black man, magnified on the screen, I fear its consequence. Not among you, who are literate people, who understand, who read, who have thought all of these consequences out and have ordered your responses, but among the masses who will be affected by what they see in a much different way, I fear, than those of us who know better. The possibility that this sexual monster, which we have not yet laid by, may raise his ugly head in terms of the film of Nat Turner is a real one with me. And coming as I do from the South, having myself been exposed to all of the sexuality in the Southern communities, the ambivalence, the attraction, the withdrawal, the hysteria, and all of these things, I all the more am sensitive to this as a possibility. In addition to that, I am a father with a daughter who is 17 years old, a son who is 16, another daughter who is 11. A part of my obligation to my children is that I construct for them some heroic figure that confers upon them a sense of their importance denied them by our racist boards of education, which to this day refuse to include even Mr. Styron's version of history and what is being taught to our black youngsters today. When I draw a lot from Jewish experience, because the Jews have been relevant to the history of the black man for a long time, although there is a tendency in the black community now to cease being black Jews and to become black Irishmen, and this explains a lot of the trouble we undergo. There is, at present, as expressed in an article in the New York Times, concern in the Jewish community about the fact that 25%, 30%, 40% of the marriages in Jewish families take place between youngsters who marry outside the religion. And you might say, so what? That's fine, let it go, forget it. It's good to happen. But what does that mean to those who think that being a Jew is an important thing and that that thing should be continued? What must the Jews do to enable their children to want to marry Jews more than they want to marry the blondes they see associated with the motor cars and the razor blades? They must find heroes and heroines among their own people who so clearly represent that which is positive and beautiful and healthy that their children will look and say, aha, that is for me. And if this is true for the Jews, how much more must it be true for the blacks? I have two daughters for whom I must find husband. That's a part of my responsibility. I do not throw them in the streets and say, root hog or die. I know that their possibilities of their marrying whites is extremely limited. I would like them to marry somebody black. I'm prejudiced to that extent. I would like also that the youngsters I see in the schools every day, in whose eyes the absence of a positive, healthy concept gleams either as hostility or self-defeat and self-hatred, who either now are taking drugs or will shortly take drugs out of self-hatred for themselves, I would like to be able to give them some positive, healthy figure to say, here, black boys and girls, is a black man who was a master and a major and is worthy of your adoration and of your love and of your respect. Though he fought and died, he fought bravely, he fought for freedom. And he was worthy to be considered and included in the pantheon of heroes that we present to all mankind. If that hero comes into my family being motivated to the least degree by his love for a white woman, already there's an ambivalence that I must deal with. You don't have to perhaps deal with it, but I do. How do I deal with it? How? I need from Nat Turner and the facts of his history to make that thing which glorifies blackness in a society which is horrified by blackness. I wonder if Nat, in the book written by Mr. Sterren, had loved a black woman, as some people said he was married to a black woman. I wonder if the book would have been as exciting to those of us who read it. I wonder to what degree we were not attracted by this taboo, this lascivious concept of the black lecherous male reaching out to touch the forbidden flesh of the white maiden. That makes a stark picture, and it possibly to some perverted minds helped sell the book. Not to the literate, I'm sure, but to somebody. Let me sum up my argument, which is an emotional one, I assure you, because I respond to the situation emotionally. Let me sum up by saying, once again, that I respect Mr. Sterren as an individual. I admire him as an individual for the things that I know that he's done. I respect his talent and his right to use that talent. That is, as long as he respects his own integrity, I respect his right to do that. I respect his right to write the book any way he wants to. But at the same time, the social consequences of a book do not necessarily always act out the good intentions of the writers themselves. If we in our country have decided that race and color are nonsensical, that these are things that are adventitious to the human condition and no longer need we concern ourselves with them, then I say to the book, all success. But if on the other hand, in our own hearts and minds, subconsciously, we feel that it is of no consequence that a black man loves a black woman, and that we like to see our black heroes on our motion picture screens only when they are being helpful to white people, and that it doesn't concern us that when they are helpful to black people, because black people being helped do not matter. If we would still give to Hattie McDaniels an Oscar for her sterling performance as the wonderful Mammy in Gone with the Wind, when she portrayed the touching depth of human devotion to the little child, Rhett Butler, and his wife, when she cared so much that she was the structural supporting member of that family. If you and me and I, if we have not learned to ask yet, whatever happened to Mammy's children of her own, who took care of them, who gave them love, who fixed their breakfast, who cared if they went to jail, if we cannot ask ourselves that about Mammy, if we cannot see that Mammy was a greater traitor to her race than that lunatic thing that was portrayed by Butterfly McQueen, then I fear we do not understand the situation we face in our country. Bravo. And that we may find ourselves being taught by experience that which I hope God grants in his wisdom we learn by discussion and by talk and by reasoning together. Because if the final confrontation faces us in our country, I am not sanguine about the results. If I have overreacted, I do not apologize. I will overreact as long as I am aware that racism is in our country and is a threat to me as a black man, and that a black hero cannot honor a black woman like Bea Richards, or that Coretta King is not a woman of magnificence worthy of a black hero's going to his death, or that Medgar Evers's wife, or that Malcolm X's wife were not women worthy of the heroic black men who stood by their sides and died for them and for their children, that our black leaders can prove their value to the American society only by aspiring to white womanhood. If I cannot believe that, then I see no way of my ever being able to accept the literary tradition, even though genius spreads its tail for my delectation. I must choose to be a black man with all my defenses and all my inadequacies and all my yelling and all my screaming and all my emotionality. Because I've been a black man all these years, and I cannot stop all of a sudden when my country has not stopped yet making me pay for that fact. Thank you.
Ozzie Davis. You're listening to a discussion of the controversy surrounding William Styron's book, The Confessions of Nat Turner, with Ozzie Davis and William Styron himself, moderated by their mutual friend James Baldwin. This is From the Vault, the original weekly series produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives. For a copy of this program or to browse the other programs in this series, go to From the Vault.
Genocide and slavery. Now, Bill is saying, well, I'm saying.
I'm so sorry, I need to interrupt, but I need to do this. And I'll get back as soon as I can with it. Elliott Counseling Group has 35 counselors providing mental health services for individuals, families, couples, children, and groups. Evening and weekend appointments are often available immediately. Virtually all insurance, including state employee insurance, is accepted. There is also a self-pay sliding scale. You can contact Kevin Elliott or his staff at ElliottCounselingGroup.com. That is ELLIOTT, counselinggroup.com, or 217-398-9066. You will probably not hear all of this, but you can go to YouTube. It's James Baldwin Speaks, The Confessions of Nat Turner and the William Styron and Ossie Davis Conversation. And it's about 55 minutes long, and I will continue to play this, and I hope you continue to enjoy it. A caller called in and said they really appreciate the fact that I chose this to play and to share with you. So enjoy and appreciate.
I'm saying. It is not so much what Bill has written, which endangers the life of this republic. What endangers the life of this republic and the lives of his children and all our lives in this room, all our lives in this country, is what we make of our real history. In fact, it is a nation based on genocide. Genocide and slavery. Now, Bill has written his study of a slave insurrection from the master's point of view. No matter what I write until the day I die, I'll be writing from the slave's point of view. And the social consequences, which is what we're really talking about, of the private act, is the 20th century question, which is in this country, above all, is the most important question. It's a question of who we really are, what we really want, and really, whether or not we love ourselves enough to love our children. And Ossie is right to look on this as the abomination of desolation, because the most vivid thing about American life, the most vivid thing, is how little we love each other. And the state of our youth is an indictment against this culture, leaving aside everything else. The state of our youth, black or white, this is the most unloved and loneliest country in the world. And we deserve our leaders. Ossie is saying he will not go along with it. And Bill is trying to interpret how we got here. Thank you.
Next, we hear a rebuttal by author William Styron, who will reference a book criticizing his novel. The book, edited by John Henrik Clark, brought African-American writers, historians and literary critics together to attack the novel. The book, titled William Styron's Nat Turner, published the month following this talk, would systematically trash the fictional and factual content of Styron's novel.
Well, excuse me. I don't know how to... I don't mean to be facetious when I say that this is two hard acts to follow, because this was eloquence, and I feel very humble before it. I don't know, again, I have the unique, I think, almost, stature, in that I am the recipient of an attack by 10 Negro writers, essays which are going to be collected in a book published by Beacon Press at your local bookstore next month. It's an amazing volume. Makes me feel like Darwin or Freud or somebody. At least it has that. It's, again, without trying to stretch this out, as a measure of, astonishing to me, of what kind of bee's nest one can stir up. I suppose one could write a whole book again on just what the relationship of history and art is. I don't know myself, and I don't want to repeat myself by saying that I was trying to create a hero, thrusting myself into the skin of a black man, which it is a, in a sense, presumptuous, but not really presumptuous. Because if I cannot assume the guise, the skin of a black man, then this prevents black men from assuming the guise and the skin of white men. And we are surely at an impasse if that exists. I'm rather relieved that Ossie has only one thing to quarrel with about the book, namely the relationship between Nat Turner and Margaret Whitehead. Most of my other critics, and they are by and large distinguished black men, run the whole panoply of historical error, that I had distorted history by having that taught by his white master instead of by his parents, as the records indicate, or purportedly indicate, so on. The indictments laid against the book are really quite astonishing. They are manifold. They go on and on and on. I am finally relieved of any artistic, I'm afraid, within the framework of these 10 essays, of any artistic freedom whatsoever. And this gets me to a singular point which Ossie touched upon when he said, and, you know, our memories betray us, when he said something like, just now, I want a hero who will represent something for my children, my black children. I want a hero who will, I'm paraphrasing again, I want a hero who will be representative of all that is noble, heroic, with all the good things, and I'm not being ironic, in black people. Well, there's a terrible fact about Nat Turner which has to be faced. And I'm saying this here for the first time, certainly in public. If we examine Nat Turner, or put it this way, if I were to make a public reading of the 5,000 word document called The Confessions of Nat Turner, published in 1831, which is the jumping off point for all the criticism against the book, that is, where my book does not correspond to those so-called truths, which I say so-called because I believe even that document is questionable. If I were to give a reading here, it would take about 50 minutes, maybe an hour, no more, and then were to pass out a questionnaire asking each of you intelligent, receptive people to tell me what kind of person emerged from this single document. And again, I'm jumping now because I can't swear to it because we haven't done this. I'm willing to bet that the image you would get out of this man would be a certainly gifted, enormously intelligent, but totally crazed, fanatical butcher. A man who had no strategy, had no intellectual underpinning for what he did. A man who embarked upon an absolute crazy adventure of slaughter, killing 55 white people, rather ruthlessly, most of them helpless women and children, and whose total outcome was disaster. Now, I say this with great caution, but with conviction, because I believe it to be true in terms of the evidence. And I would wager that a jury faced with this evidence would come to that conclusion. Now, what I am saying is this. I studied hard and long this man's record, this man's story. And somewhere behind, I studied for 10 years or more. And I found somewhere deep within the lines the fact, or at least the notion, that this man was not this ruthless butcher, but he was something else, that he was what I said earlier on this evening, that he was a hero, that he was a man of enormous resilience, fantastic vision, who did indeed, out of desperation, rise up in a kind of awesome nobility and grandeur and perform, like Martin Luther, that which he had to do. Now, I am only asking you to believe that it was art, and I hope I'm not sounding pretentious. that it was art, my art, which discovered what I truly believe to be the true nobility in this man and turned him into the liberator that I think he is in the book.
Thank you.
I think that's good for you. Very well done, Jim.
Thank you. This will be my last statement, which I shall hope to be brief. I began my first statement to you with two presumptions, gross and egregious, that I felt in being in this position, and I shall close by telling you what the third presumption is. But before I do that, one or two comments relating not necessarily to Mr. Styron's book, but to the uses of books in relations, in this instance, to black people in America. I've often wondered, I imagine you have too, how such an important book as Uncle Tom's Cabin, creating a character, Uncle Tom, who Mr. Lincoln said was one of the causes of the Civil War, should ultimately wind up being so despised and hated by the black people. Why did this happen? The Miss Stowe certainly had no axe to grind against blacks. She was by no means a racist. Her intention really was to alleviate the conditions of the black men and women in our country. And yet, somehow, ultimately, we came to hate and despise Uncle Tom. There are two reasons, and they're relevant to what we're talking about tonight. One is that Uncle Tom, for all of his great values, was given to us and did not grow out of our own experience. We did not create him. He came from someone else. The second and far more subtle point was that Uncle Tom's characteristics were created basically to elicit the sympathy of the white community, who had the power to do something about Uncle Tom's condition. This was because Uncle Tom couldn't do it himself. Now, we've had two kinds of heroes in our country, two kinds of black heroes. Those who were modeled on Uncle Tom, those who did not have the power to change their condition, but had only the power by their own morality and their goodness and their sanctity to make white people guilty enough to change it. That was one kind of hero. And there was the other kind, the outsider. The rebel, Nat Turner, Denmark Vesey, Gabriel Prosser, guys like Marcus Garvey, who organized more black people into political instrument than anybody else. The outsiders, the Malcolm X's, who never compromised, who never felt that the white man should be made to feel guilty, who never felt that they had to rely on white power for whatever it was that needed to be done. Now, in the black community now, there is a new thing happening. The black community has rejected the old terms of communication between the black community and the white community. The old images no longer work. The old language no longer holds water. What is really happening, and what is a part of what is good here tonight, is that the black community is speaking in a new language to which it hopes the white community will respond in a new fashion. Now, the great trouble with the white liberal has always been not that he didn't like black folks, but that he was so intelligent, so knowledgeable, so full of the answers and the statistics that he didn't have to listen to what the black man's question was. And before we ask the question, he's often running with the solution. Finally, it comes to this: wait, damn it, and let me ask you the question. Don't understand me too soon, because my manhood is involved with what you do to save my life. You must help me, if you will, get into a position to do it myself. This is the stage in which we find ourselves now. Those in our communities in the past who have been helpful have found a response from that kind of leadership that we had, the accommodationist leadership, who never relied on the power of the black people ever to get what black people needed to get. we always had to rely on the good intentions of whites. In order to merit that good intentions, we created a language, we created an attitude, we created a thing of ourselves which was not quite a man, because that could not get the job done. We modeled ourselves on Uncle Tom because it was a necessity of survival. That aspect of our existence in this country is over and done with. Black people will stand and be counted as men, no better, no worse than other men, or they will die. They will no longer accept any kind of accommodation that does not recognize, in the beginning, their rights to stand up as men. One of the things that I object to about Bill Styron's Nat Turner is that a white man gave it to me in the first place. Now, this is irrational and yet perfectly logical and perfectly true and perfectly necessary for me at this moment, and leads me to what I say is my third presumption in discussing this book with you tonight. The third and most profound presumption with which I am burdened is, if I love Nat so much and my kids needed him, why the hell didn't I spend 5 years and write my Nat Turner before Bill Styron wrote his Nat Turner, right? I think this is an intelligent question. And I have to say that to some degree I am guilty of not having done it. I think I could write a Nat Turner. I could make my own statement about him. Why then have I not done it? I won't go into the reasons why. They have to do with my position in this society all this time. But a part of the discussion tonight, I hope, will leave in all of our minds that the black community is determined now to not only create its own black heroes and its own Nat Turners and to use its own instrumentalities to establish its own identity, but will even bite the hand that feeds us in order to establish the right to do that. And we're not the first to have done this, nor will we be the last. Jesus Christ was once a Jewish boy. You might have forgotten that. Now, those of you who worship him as a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant Jesus, well, he was taken by one culture and made into another culture hero because they needed him so desperately. And in Detroit, Michigan, Jesus is undergoing another kind of acculturation. He's being made into a black Jesus because the black ghetto says we're going to have a black Jesus, and they're going to have him. The artistic sensitivities of the people will rise to create what they need out of the bare bones of the facts of the truth. Otherwise, art would not be necessary. We cannot yet live with the truth or the facts. It is what we do with them that determines what we are as peoples. Mr. Styron, I think, honestly expressed what he needed to express growing out of his situation in a culture that he and his people created. He did not feed me something that I culturally need, and there is no way that he could do it in reality. Now, this has nothing to do with his capacity to get inside the hide of Nat Turner. Of course he can do that. All this requires is artistic sympathy and artistic empathy and communion. He may suffer from the fact that we live a dual life in our country, especially black men. We are what gets along well in the white world because we survive at that. But when your backs are turned, sometimes we are something quite different because we have to survive as what we also are. We are split apart by this dichotomy. And I think we will no longer be split apart. That if in our anguish to come to full manhood, if in our desire to assume cultural control of our own communities, we are boorish and loud and clamorous and write 10 essays, if we make all the mistakes in the world, we claim our right so to do, and you should be proud that at long last, all of these helpless colored folks who are always around you with petitions and flags and placards are going to stop coming to your community and going to stand up and take the responsibility to rebuild themselves in whatever image they see fit to make of themselves. And I must say, with the images floating around now, it may be that we will, out of our needs, create something that you will have to take 10 years from now. Thank you very kindly.
All I can say is I'm hopelessly smitten by a statement like that, and it's absolute truth, and I'm humbled by it. And Maybe there's nothing much more to say, really. I'll...
All right. You got pretty much all of this. There's like maybe a half a minute left of comment. But that was explodingly beautiful, wasn't it? And stimulating conversation. So we'll be listening for our caller, Annette Simmons, the author of The Story Factor, to call in, and I will be answering her call. Make sure I turn on everything so that Annette calls in. I am ready for her. So I ask that she give me a few more minutes before she called, rescheduled a bit, so that I could conclude this recording, because I think it was absolutely worthy of listening to. And I would only share with you something that I thought was worthy for all of us to listen to and to grow through. All right, a couple of announcements as I wait for Annette to call in. And everything is on. Yes, yes, yes. Disability Resource Exposition is coming up, and it's going to be the 15th of October at the Fluid Center. The 10th annual Disability Resource Expo happening. And that will be from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Fluid Event Center, 601 North County Fair Drive in Champaign. The expo is host to nearly 100 local, regional, and statewide organizations and businesses that serve Champaign County, representing services and resources to any type of disability. Admission is free. There will be entertainment, games, drawings, and children's activity room. Be sure to stop and stay and say hi at the WEF table featuring Disability Beat, a WEF public affairs program. That's October 15th, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Fluid Event Center in Champaign. That's 601 North County Fair Drive in Champaign. Okay, I'm glad I got that one out. Oh, yes, and this is WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, streaming online at WEF.org. Okay, still looking at the board, making sure that my guest calls in and I don't miss the call. Because, you know, sometimes I get a little frazzled. If you know me by now, I'm not the most technical, relaxed person. Okay, here we go. We've got a call now. Hello, Annette.
Good morning. This is Annette Simmons. How are you?
I know, Annette. I know. Oh, Annette, thank you so much. I guess it has something to do with you, too, where I could ask you. I said, can you permit me to delay your time that I said and all the other storytelling thing that I've done in terms of our relationships and how you and I have met? It's quite a story, I would say. A natural one, more into reality, my reality.
Everyone's reality. I love your phrase, the ambiguity of reality. That's just as perfect. Can I borrow that?
I thought that was yours, you know, somewhere.
Probably.
I think
probably.
I read somewhere this is ambiguity in that, and that we oftentimes are always facing ourselves with the fact is, or someone is, or something is giving us the facts. And that's it. Facts without real consideration for what does it mean to be human and to live as a human.
Mm-hmm. Do you know the military is actually catching on to that?
Oh, really?
Yes. They've defined this term called situational awareness.
Okay.
So, you know, they have to sound all official about it. But what it means is that you just don't know till you get there.
You just don't know till you get there. Situational
situation.
Awareness. You know what? One of the things I like about reading your book, and, you know, there's some things about your book I really appreciate because of the fact that I think that what you've written about is what we already do. But there may not be an awareness that we're already doing that. And we're always coming up with terminologies and ways of trying to structure what we already do. And it becomes, and I think your book touches upon that. In fact, I know it does. It touches upon the fact, don't get stuck into the semantics or the mechanics of storytelling, but be authentic and realizing, you know, don't get in, I'm gonna show you all this, but then I want you to just forget about all of this structure and stuff and just come and show up, all right?
Show up.
Oftentimes we don't get that permission. We're often being told how to do what we're already doing, and then it's given back to us in a way that says, now you've got to think about the way I told you to do it in order for you to be valid. And that, to me, gets stuck in the technical and the factual. And that's not what you're talking about in your book. Your book, The Story Factor, Inspiration, Influence, and Persuasion Through the Art of Storytelling. And so, Annette Simmons, there's a foreword in here, of course you know, by Doug Littman, where he says in the book, the story factor brings together three trends that have belonged together all along. First, the rebirth of the storytelling art around the developed world and subsequent appreciation for the mental and emotional processes it unleashes. Second, the emerging realization in the business community that thriving organizations need whole persons working for them and that anything less cheats both the individual and the firm. And finally, the successes of practical psychologies in helping us achieve lasting influence through respectful relationships. And I thought, you know, it does say, pretty much summarizes, in a sense, where we are today in terms of technology, in terms of, what does it say, corporations are people, and all the different, situational awareness, all these analogies and or therapies or psychological terminologies we're using now to look at things differently, but not quite ready to take that leap in doing it different. And how does storytelling shift that, encourages that actual movement in how we're doing it?
I think, and to further that, I think that what happened, because that Doug wrote that in the year 2000, and so it's been a while that we've had the realization, but I don't think we communicated well to the people who are designing the technology and who are analyzing the data, because when you're thinking in terms of facts, you come to a different conclusion than if you're thinking in terms of people. And so what we've done is we've got all of these people arguing with each other about facts that never have taken into consideration the people. And unfortunately, I don't know what your experience has been over the last, gosh, it's been, what, 17 years since he wrote that, but the more technology takes this fact-only thinking, this people-less thinking, and turns it into algorithms and systems, I think the less humane our decisions have become, especially at the corporate and even at the government level. It's our challenge now to start to blend the thinking of fact with the thinking about people and people's well-being. And when we do that, we bring it together. I'm facing a lot of people who want to turn storytelling into just another algorithm these days. And so that's the new challenge I've had. Mm-hmm. And as you might imagine, I'm holding out, because this is something that you actually have to have a human presence. You were talking about how we're told, we don't give permission to show up. My favorite example is you're checking out of the grocery store, and the cashier, poor thing, says, did you find everything okay? Because that's what she was told to say, or he. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And yet, it's so much nicer if a person is allowed to be a person, mm-hmm. and they can look in your face, and sometimes they may say, tough day today, or they may say, wow, you look lovely today. Whatever it is, they get a chance to show up and be a human being, and that makes me feel like a human being. I think a lot of corporations could go a long way in trusting people to be people.
Well, it's interesting, too, that you make that observation, because I'm making that observation all the time when I go through the line and they ask me, did I find everything okay? And I'll say, well, I found a few things out of order here and there. And and then I'll immediately follow up with, that's my joke for the day. Well, you know. And then I'd like to share with you another experience I had yesterday in a new grocery store that opened up. And everybody was smiling. It's a brand new store. And everyone was smiling. And there were samples and different things that this particular place offered, because things were local. And there were more small businesses that were providing the produce, or providing what was being sold in the store. And so you had this engaging, and you had these people that were literally smiling. And this one person says, I love my team. And so I said, I'll come back. My husband and I both will come back, not just for the food, and but we'll come back for the smiles, because we've lost touch with why we're selling these things. Why are we always thinking about food and buying and getting, and forgetting that you are providing food, and these people who are providing the food are also people too. So there's this whole interaction going on, and it's absolutely wonderful when we can be aware of that. But the thing that I want to address, and I know you are an artist storytelling, because I want to talk about that, why you did this book and why it's in its third edition and now it's in audio. But you wanted the topic for My Higher Ground to be reducing the high rate of incarceration in the U.S. through the art of storytelling. So different story, different policy regarding incarceration. Changing the story changes the national conversation. Telling a story gives people the opportunity to come to the same conclusion you have without telling them what to think. So I'm really interested in how we're going to do that. I mean, not how we're going to do it, because I believe we are doing it. There are many ways in which this story has been told and the facts have been repeated over and over again. So tell me about that.
Well, it's very personal to me, because my father was a federal probation officer, and I was growing up in the 70s, and that was before mandatory sentencing. And my daddy would go out, and if somebody was in trouble and they had been convicted before they were sentenced, my dad would go out and he'd meet their mother, their, you know, cousins, the people they hung out with, and he could put together a team of people who would work with him in helping this person turn his life around. Now, this narrative, tough on crime, was introduced around the 70s, and then the other narrative is the war on drugs. And so once you start to think in terms of war, then the rules of war start to seem appropriate. Mm. And once you decide that you are tough on crime, then you only have one solution to any problem that has to do with crime, and that is to get tough or to get tougher.
Mm.
Well, the thing is that it's a mindless narrative, and it makes some people feel good, because you don't want to be weak on crime. Mm. And so this tough on crime seemed like the answer. The answer, however, turned into mandatory sentencing, where no longer, and my father retired because, you know, he couldn't help people anymore. And so with mandatory sentencing, people got thrown into prison for long periods of time when it really wasn't appropriate. And then they started this war on drugs, and that meant that nonviolent offenders were being thrown into prison. And you know what? For some people, if you get tough on them, they turn around, they get tougher back.
Mm.
And so with a nonviolent criminal in a prison situation could end up becoming violent and probably experience violence themselves, which is what turns people violent.
Mm-hmm.
So now the only reason, and I'm afraid to say this, but the only reason that they're starting to rethink it is because this is incredibly expensive, and it doesn't work, and the data proves it. We have, in Louisiana, where I live, the highest incarceration rate in the United States, and the United States has the highest incarceration rate of all the countries, I think I may be living in a place with the highest incarceration rate in the world. And that is tragic because I'm surrounded by lots of really good people, and we need to do something about this. Now, the data is what caused this turnaround. All of a sudden, you won't hear so much tough on crime. Now we're using the phrase smart on crime.
Mm.
And the conservatives are adapting it, and they call it right on crime because they like to be right. Well, that's okay. It's a bipartisan effort. Let's work with that. And if that's the narrative, then all of a sudden we can start to make distinct decisions that are situational. And in some cases, particularly with nonviolent offenders, getting tougher on them doesn't make them less dependent on drugs. I mean, it just doesn't work that way.
Okay. Give me some more.
Well, when I have worked with, there's the Pew Charitable Trust has been invited into Louisiana, and they are working on the data part of this. And so if anybody, and all of the states have rolled back significant portions of the legislation that occurred while this story, tough on crime, was popular. Unfortunately, in Louisiana, we're having a tough time rolling it back. This is a very conservative state, very Republican, and we now have a new Democratic governor, which I'm really looking forward to some of the things that he's going to do. He has a whole lot to undo. Bobby Jindal was our governor for many years, and he towed the party line and was, well, I won't talk about him. So today, there are people who are investigating. So tell me the story about what happened. And when we can look at that, we begin to realize that you have to keep thinking. You can't put a decision, lock it in, and then stop thinking about it. When, you know, Jesus told a lot of parables, and as a matter of fact, when Jesus was asked 183 different direct questions in the New Testament, I didn't count them, someone else did, and he gave about two or three direct answers. What Jesus did was communicate with parables, with stories. And the wisdom of that is that when you begin to look at the story of what happened, then you realize that there are different answers for different situations. The answer to any question, particularly what do we do about crime, is it depends. It depends on what crime you're talking about. It depends on, and if we could get so, go back to where it could depend on an investigation that reveals, you know, this person actually just slipped, made a mistake, and hasn't, you know, is able to get another job and return to the community, then you begin to realize from the inside of the situation that there are many different answers. From the outside of the situation, they like to look at just one answer. One of the examples from the Bible is that the Pharisees were trying to corner Jesus and say, well, isn't it wrong to heal on the Sabbath? Because it's wrong to work on the Sabbath. And instead of giving a yes or no answer, Jesus told a parable. And he said, if your ox fell into a ditch on the Sabbath, would you walk right past and let it die? No. The beauty of story is that it pulls someone into a situation so that they think about what's appropriate here and now. And that goes back to what you were talking about with the response of people at this store. They're available. They're paying attention to recognize that in they have an opportunity to choose for themselves And that means to show up and be present and be a human being so that other people feel like they can be human beings too.
Mm-hmm. Because one of the things that I did say, my husband and I talked about this afterwards, and one of the comments I made is that I hope that after the newness of the store wears off, that they will still be smiling when, you know, over time, this smile will still be there. And I thought, I said, oh, that's too, I said, perhaps maybe I'm being too naive, and I've heard that before many years ago. You're too idealistic, or you're too naive. And I'm thinking, no, smiling and people treating one another as human beings, it's not naive. And that we are human, and that we are in denial of our humanity, of our humanness, is
absolutely
abnormal.
And technology encourages us to continue to deny our humanity. I think that I was just at a talk last night about how our cities and towns have started to look at numbers and make decisions about numbers without thinking about the community. The inner community, which is largely in decline at this point, has been neglected in order to build these huge developments out away from the city, you know, white flight, gated communities. And for a city to sustain these communities is a losing proposition. There's absolutely no way over time. But where the money is actually inner city. Mm. And if we begin to reinvest in our inner city, then we're going to find that we have created a community that we can sustain and that works better for the human beings that are in it. I think that there's nothing but trouble when people decide they're going to move all the way as far as way they can get from the problem of poverty and frankly, poverty and maintenance of what we have. If you don't live in your own city, then you're not paying attention to reinvesting in it and keeping it alive. Ultimately, I think this is going to go the same way as the crime. They're going to realize that it's unsustainable financially. And if that's what has to happen to bring them back into the fold and start acting like neighbors and human beings again, so be it. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's naive. I simply think that you're looking ahead, knowing that when things are new, you have more of an optimistic point of view. When things need to be maintained, if people are trying to shove that responsibility onto someone else, well, none of us are happy because everybody's pointing the finger at everybody else and nothing's getting fixed. Most of life is maintenance. It's not the beginning.
That is so
true.
That is so true. It's like being married. Every day is not exciting. It's work. It's mundane. It's the same thing or similar. Not the same thing, but it's okay. It's being. It's presence. It's whatever. But it's not an event. Anniversaries, birthdays, Christmas, holidays, all these different things and travel. It is every day. And that's life. It's every day.
That's life.
The ambiguity.
And we've neglected it for too long. We neglected it in terms of how we do our judicial system, and we've neglected it in terms of how we run our municipality.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you talk about six kinds of stories. The first story being who? Okay, no, you go ahead.
Well, when I first wrote that book, it was back in 2000, and let me tell you how it came to story.
Okay.
I was facilitating dialogue between people. Daddy raising me, he would take whatever psychology he was learning to work on criminals, and he'd use it on me.
Of course.
He'd teach me about it. And so I grew up thinking in terms of psychology. And when I went to school, my daddy, I wanted to study psychology, and he was like, no, you won't listen to people's problems. So I had to study marketing, which is really psychology.
Of course.
It's just a different kind. And so when I began to work in marketing, I worked at a big advertising agency, J. Walter Thompson. You know, I wasn't really that interested in getting people to buy cars that they didn't really need yet, but that was my job. Mm-hmm. I was more interested in having a room full of the most brilliant minds, because J. Walter Thompson is a famous agency. We used to say it's a great place to work if your parents can afford to send you there.
Mm.
And they had the smartest people in the room, and I swear there were times those people couldn't have even figured out how to order a pizza.
Mm.
The intelligence that just seeps away when people argue is a terrible way.
Mm-hmm.
And I was curious, well, how can I get these people to actually talk to each other and work together?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when I wrote my first two books. One was on territorial gain, and the second one was A Safe Place for Dangerous Truth. I figured out a way to get a large group of people to actually tell the truth in the room without losing their mind.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they can only do that for a couple of hours, and then they have to go back to being what they are natural, but at least we can do it. I found out that storytelling was the number one tool. When someone tells the story of who they are, then it changes everything, because they can look them straight in the eye, and they can say, I know what I'm talking about, and this is what you should do. And nobody's going to listen, and they're not going to listen because they're not sure that person is a good person. They're not sure what their agenda is. They don't know who they are or why they're there. And so anything they say gets filtered through this mistrust,
mm-hmm.
and many times, you know, justifiable mistrust. I realized that if I could get these people to tell their story, to tell their who I am story, then others could make a decision on their own, which is what they're going to do anyway. You can't walk into a room and say, hey, my name is Annette, and I'm trustworthy. I'm here for the right reasons. But nobody's going to believe you.
Mm-mm.
But if the best case would be that they'd know you. They'd known you since you was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd know that you're a good person, you're here for the right reasons. But in most cases today, we don't know each other like that.
Mm-hmm.
But if I tell you a story mm-hmm. about who I am and where I've been, like I told you a story about my daddy, then you get to make a decision about what kind of person I am. And then if you decide that you think I'm a good person, then you're going to listen to me. And so, well, a little bit anyway. And so that's what I learned when I was facilitating dialogue, and then I decided that's where I would turn my attention. Now, when I started teaching people how to tell stories, I learned that when you start working on your story, story starts working on you.
Mm-hmm.
So I ask people to tell their who I am story, and it actually forces them to sit down and think, well, who am I?
Mm-mm.
And when they come up with a story, so the way I do it is I ask you to think of a quality that you bring to this group, that if you weren't there, they wouldn't have that quality. And sometimes it's perseverance, sometimes it's spontaneity, sometimes it's reliability. There's different gifts. Everybody has a gift, has many gifts. And so then I ask you to work backwards. So if your quality is, let's say, reliability, I think there are four buckets you can look in to find a story, and I believe in the 3-minute story. We don't have time to, you know, listen to people's life stories. But if we can find a little vignette, a little anecdote
mm-hmm.
about us being, well, talking to this person who is reliable, there's four different situations where you can find a story. One is a time when it really cost you to be reliable. And when you tell that story, somebody can see that no matter what, you're going to be reliable. So that's a time you shine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a second place to look for that story is a time you blew it, which is when you actually didn't even meet your own standards and you felt bad about it. It's interesting how you get double points for that because you're displaying humility at the same time. Mm-hmm. You're talking about reliability. And if you tell a story about a time when you felt like you weren't reliable, mm-hmm. people can hear the pain in your voice.
Mm-hmm.
They know that you've decided that you're just not going to let that happen again. They can tell. And so that's a good source of a story.
Mm-hmm.
The third one is a mentor. Maybe it was your grandmother that taught you about that. And when you tell a story about your grandmother, then people know that's you too.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't have noticed that story. You wouldn't have remembered it if it wasn't important to you.
Mm.
And the last one is sometimes you can just borrow a scene from a movie or a book and you tell it. And the way you tell it, people can follow along in the development of the story where this happens and then that happens and then that happens. And at the end of it, they say, wow, this person really understands reliability. I think this person is reliable.
Mm. Mm. I think we already talk that way. It's just that we don't pay much attention, I think, to if we're giving that kind of information. Like, we're so guarded sometimes now where that was just something we would just ordinarily do. Just have a
Absolutely,
conversation
yeah.
and share about how our day is going, really, you know, talk about some problem we may be having or some, you know, need something from you and ask you, can you help me with that? It was so natural to do that. And now I see that oftentimes it's lacking the emotion. It's lacking a connection to this person who is providing the service or who is doing the job or the employer or the employee or...
And absolutely, I think that's because we stopped making humane decisions
mm.
and we started making what is called rational decisions, but mm. rational is about numbers.
Mm.
And there's no people, you can't see any faces in the numbers. And so I truly believe that in order to solve some of these problems, particularly the crime, the incarceration issue, we're going to have to start looking at faces as well as numbers.
Okay. So who am I? Okay, so we could also ask the question of who am I as a probation officer? Who am I as a judge? Who am I as a lawyer? Who am
Absolutely.
I as the person who is incarcerated, who perhaps committed the crime, the person who is doing drugs or whatever? That question, who am I, actually, as you said, ask you to go inside and say, who am I? And what have my actions and my behaviors been to support that, who I am? Do I even think about who I am and how my actions and my thoughts and my behaviors, all these things are influencing other people and even influencing me returning to the action, again and again and again without really looking at how it's impacting me or impacting others?
And I have a friend, Michael McCarthy, in California, who uses this Who I Am story in prison and has had incredible results because, it's dehumanizing to be in prison. And so I can't even imagine how hard it must be to be human. And so when he works with people, prisoners, and helps them come up with their Who I Am story. He's called me several times just to say, oh my gosh, this is working so well. And what happens is that he went in to do storytelling, which you can imagine what a warden thinks about a man coming in saying, I would like to teach prisoners storytelling. He just rolls his eyes and says, well, if they'll come, fine. He did one session, and when he came back for the next session, he said he was worried that the room was completely empty. And guards said,
where are you? I can't hear you.
They were all lined up, ready to come in, and the warden just wasn't sure how many he could put into that course.
Mm-hmm. And it's also validating, in a sense, when you tell a story. It validates my connection to my reality, or my connection to my humanity, or my connection to my purpose, or why am I here, which is the next, you have six now,
yes.
Six kinds of stories. Why am I here? Why am I in this space? Why am I on the radio? What am I here for? What's in it for me? What's in it to my listeners? You know, all of us are in it for something. And what are we in it for? Why are we here for? We don't know why we're here. We're here, but we don't know. And our reality is telling us something, why are we here?
Well,
but that question, why are we here?
The life asks us that question.
Yes,
life
yes.
asks us, why are you here?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that the most powerful place to start is, you know, what is your purpose on earth? Why are you here? Now, that's a little deep for maybe people driving the radio and listening to the radio, but it's worth thinking about because, and let's go back to the prison population. When you reclaim what your purpose in life is, then everything gets easier, and particularly deciding what you do, is mm-hmm. it achieving my purpose or is it not?
Mm-hmm.
I like to think about my purpose as my job is to bring humanity back to places where it's gone missing.
Mm.
And so when I am in a situation where I'm frustrated or angry, it's just so much easier to remember my why I am here story.
Mm.
And it's like, am I here to make this person mad? No. So I can then come up with a lot more creative solutions because when we feel anger or fear, it narrows our thinking. So why I am here is not just good in terms of selling yourself to other people or selling ideas to other people. It's, for me, the most powerful way to manage my own emotions when it gets hard.
Mm-hmm. I was reading one of your blogs. Let me remind our listeners who I'm talking with. The Story Factor by Annette Simmons is her book. And this is Annette Simmons on the phone right now with us. Is that, what's his name? Tony Swartz. Abuse of the Story Art. And you did write this blog, correct?
Yes.
And I thought it was quite interesting, too, because I knew of something of this book, the Donald Trump, you know, about Donald Trump. But there was this kind of regret that it says deep remorse for ghostwriting this, The Art of the Deal by Donald, autobiography of Donald Trump. And in here, there's an abuse of story. And that we often can use story to also slant things in a way that is serving you. It serves you. It benefits you in a superficial way, perhaps. But in a profitable way, it may benefit you to tell that story, just like the story about incarceration and tough on crime. And I'm sure there was a story. There's stories around those things. But what about when we're using story in order to get things, profit from story, and then we use that also, as he's looking at it, as you're writing this, he has a remorse, too, about, okay, this was my story, but as I look at my story, I also see another story that's being born from that. That is a story of remorse.
Well, he sold out. And he said he sold out.
Yes.
He was asked to write a story about this man, about Trump. He was asked to co-write the autobiography. He did the interviews. All he found were lies and superficialities. And so he decided that he would ignore whatever his why I'm here story is, and he would just do it for the money.
Mm-hmm.
And believe me, he made a lot of money out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So when people are using storytelling to profit themselves at the expense of others, you know, that's exploitation. And that's why, you know, old-timers like to say, now you've gone to telling stories. And what they meant when they said that was you've gone to lying. And so storytelling absolutely can be just a pack of lies. And when people use that, what they're doing is they're using what they know about emotions. And they're using what they know about cultural stories, which our big cultural story is the American dream, which it constantly promotes growth without any sort of restraint. And he used that story to sell books and to make Donald Trump look like a genius, a business genius. Now, when it turns out that telling those lies caused a person who is not fit to be president to actually get in a position where he's nominated for president, then Tony Schwartz comes clean and he says, I'm sorry for what I did. I did the wrong thing. And he went public with it. And I'm glad he did. But I'm hoping that we can begin to educate people about the danger of abusing a story. There's a wonderful TED Talk by a woman from Africa whose name I can't pronounce.
I think I might have right listened now. To that one. I think I've listened
the
to that one.
The danger of a single story?
Yes.
Yes. And she grows up, you know, and she's reading all these, you know, British books about little children eating apples and you know, she grows up in Africa. She doesn't see her story reflected in there. And so when she doesn't see her story reflected in there, she begins to think that her story isn't as good as these British stories. And now she's a novelist and incredibly talented, and it's a wonderful TED Talk. And the danger of a single story, I would think that blog that I wrote has a whole lot to do with that danger.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the things that I think is very practical about your book, and that is that we're already, all of us are already doing storytelling. We're creating stories all the time about our day and how we're doing, what we did, and what we achieved or didn't achieve, our relationships. There's always a story. My concern is, and this is a really strong topic, is that once we hear a story, or once we go to a conference, let's say a conference about, crime and how, as social workers, as politicians, as lobbyists, as community people, activists, whatever, and this is what we can do, and we have many different ways in which we can approach a problem or approach the idea that there's this problem and there's this problem of a particular population of people who are doing this. And yet we are not changed by the story. This is what I'm concerned about, is the fact that I have a conversation with my husband. I'll give you an example. One of it is, he says, we're walking our dog and the dog poops twice now. You got to take a dog for a walk. Dog's got to poop. But then it'll start biting on, gnawing on the leash that he's holding. And he said out of observation, because I've seen this happen. We've had this dog for several years. And it'll start biting on the leash as if it's playing, but he'll say, stop, stop. So the other day he said, okay, she does that. She poops twice and then she bites on the leash. And then I said, and then what do you do? He says, and then I say, stop. And then I tell her to stop. And then I said, okay. And she, you know, and she'll do that again. And it's like, oh, this is in her DNA. This is her nature, you know, to poop twice. And I got to poop twice. And then I got to gnaw on the leash. And then you say, stop, stop. But he doesn't see himself in the story. I said, you said, stop, stop twice. He said, yes, I know. But she keeps biting on the leash. I said, where are you in this? He doesn't see himself in it. And so I
really?
Said, so we keep talking. And so eventually we get to the part where it's really difficult. It's like, okay, it's something about that I'm doing again. You know, the story about where you walk down the street and you fall in the hole.
Absolutely.
You walk down. But what do you want them to do? Change, fix the hole? Or can you go around? They might suggest, can you just go around, go a different way? No, I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to keep going because you need to fix that hole.
Well,
so my question is, here's Annette, is this. When you hear a story and it's moving, Jesus spoke in parables, yes. And those stories were very moving. And if he just answered the question and said, do this, they would still, even if they had the story and the disciples had the story, they had the master with them. But Peter denied him three times. What is it about the story that gets your attention and moves you to action?
The secret to a story to move someone to action is the emotional connection. And if it's emotional enough, it will register. So, for instance, throughout life as adults, we go along and we're just going to keep doing what we do until we face a situation where we simply can't continue doing that. For instance, alcoholics, they call it hitting bottom. And so there has to be what I call a significant emotional event that is so profound that you just can't pretend to yourself that it's not your problem anymore. You can't pretend to yourself that, that or it's so bad that maybe it is somebody else. Maybe it is, you know, you can blame it on somebody else, but you're determined you're going to find a way to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's on a big level, but it works on a small level as well.
Mm-hmm.
And unless there's a significant emotional event, now let's talk about marriage. Talking to a man and trying to get them to have a significant emotional event, well, most men are pretty well armored against our significant emotional events.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's just this practiced way of dealing with that by saying, well, that's just your opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Or so that's another story they use to protect themselves. Because, you know, it's not in human nature to want to say, okay, how am I causing this problem?
Mm.
But we all know that the most power we have in changing our lives is to ask ourselves that question.
Mm-hmm.
And so the teaching stories, that's another one, the teaching story. In this situation, I don't know about your dog, but my dog, after she poops, she feels great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's just like, woof.
So is that what she's feeling great? That's what she was feeling great. He says that. She's feeling really good now.
Yeah. And so, of course, I walk my dog off a leash so she can run a little bit, and then she has to come back and heal.
Mm-hmm.
I let her have, you know, have some freedom after that.
Mm-hmm.
But acknowledging that it's a real joyful feeling for a puppy after a poop might create a different strategy than a story that says what you are doing is not working.
Ah, that's good. I like it. Mm-hmm.
Well, you'll have to let me know if it works.
No, I like what you said, though, because I can hear myself saying what you're doing is not working. That's not working.
So, and we don't like those stories.
Yeah. So what about doing something different? And so I like that, though. It still has in there what you're not doing, Robert, is not working. Why are you doing it like that? You know, but he's saying.
But you're letting him. You're looking at it from a different point of position.
Yes.
The idea is this is joy.
Mm-hmm.
How can I connect with that joy?
Mm-hmm.
And it changes. It's amazing how you change the story and it changes everything because you're focusing on different things.
Mm. Wow. I cannot believe it, but we're pretty much out of time, girl. I have to invite you back again if you ever would like to so we can discuss some more of this book.
I would love to.
Some other context or subject in terms of how we might use and realize that the stories that we're using every day is influencing, no matter what we're doing, but it is influencing, and how we can be more awake and aware of what it is that we're doing and why we're doing it and the way that we're doing it. The Story Factor, author Annette Simmons, Inspiration, Influence, and Persuasion Through the Art of Storytelling. Thank you so much, Annette.
Can I mention my website?
Sure, please.
Okay, so my website is AnnetteSimmons.com.
Okay.
And if you want the audio book, you go on Audible.
Okay.
I've got four books on my website and with links to Amazon to get them. And I just want to offer anybody, if you want to email me and talk to me about, you know, what you're trying to do good in the community.
Okay.
If I can help with storytelling, I'd be happy to. And my email is Annette@AnnetteSimmons.com.
Okay. And Annette, I'm going to respond to something I read in your book, too, but off air. Okay.
Okay.
All righty. Thank you so much. And I appreciate you being here today. And here is my
colleague,
Paul Muth.
That'll work.
Did you want to say something?
Oh, yeah, I got an hour of things. Well,
oh, okay.
I'm actually presenting people.
I know you were showing me something, and I didn't know quite what it was. Okay, Annette, I'm going to...
It's not often that an African-American gets an obituary on the front page.
Oh, yeah.